want to speak about the first Rashi in Chumash. Half the time we'll speak about the question in Rashi and half the time what the answer is. Rashi quotes a Medrash, Omer of Yitzchak, Lohoya HaTorah LaHaskel Elam Me'achudish HaZeh Lochem Shehi Mitzvah Rishona Shemitztavu Bo Yisrael. Matam Pasach Bibreish. Question. Torah should have logically started from the first public mitzvah that the Rabban Shom gave to the Jewish people, which was the mitzvah of Kiddush HaKodesh, of sanctifying the new moon, which is in Parshas Bo. Matam Pasach Bibreish. Why did the Torah start, in fact, from Bereishis, when it should have started from the first mitzvah? The question needs explanation. If after Parshas Bo, here we have now the first mitzvah, after that it's one mitzvah after another. Pasuk after pasuk after pasuk, mitzvah, mitzvah, mitzvah. Then the Torah is a book of mitzvahs, like the Sefer HaMitzvahs of the Rambam or the Sefer HaChinuch, and therefore the most logical place to start is the first mitzvah. But even after that first mitzvah, the Torah doesn't limit itself to only giving us mitzvahs. The Torah has narratives, stories, historical information, all different kinds of things, census of the Jewish people, they counted them. So the Torah is a conglomeration of mitzvahs and stories, and therefore, why is it more logical to start from the first mitzvah than to start with the first story? Seems very logical to me, start from Bereishis. If you have a book that is a conglomeration of stories and mitzvahs, start with the first story. Why is it more logical to start with the first mitzvah? What's Rashi talking about? Why does Rabbi Yitzchak make it so clear that the Torah should have started with the first mitzvah, and there's something that needs to be explained why it didn't? There's a Rambam in Hilchos Malachim. The Rambam says like this, that all of the details of how Mashiach is going to come, no one will know how it will be until it happens. Details, what the order is going to be, is Eliyahu HaNavi going to come before Mashiach, after Mashiach, is the donkey of Mashiach going to be black, white, gray, all of those details, no one can know until it happens. And the Rambam says that the prophets were not given a prophecy concerning these details, and even the Chachamim were not given a tradition concerning these details, and therefore the Rambam says a person should not make that the mainstay of his learning. Now if the Rambam had stopped there, it would be really a self-contained cause and effect. Reason for a halacha. Don't make this the mainstay of your learning, because you're never going to come to any definite conclusions, because neither the prophets in Torah Shebichsav, in the written Torah, or the rabbis in the oral Torah had any tradition when it came to these details. So don't bother with it. Don't make that the main thing you're going to learn. But the Rambam adds one more sentence. She'ein ha'dvorim ho'elu mevi'enes ha'odam lo lidei yiras Hashem ve'lo lidei avas Hashem. These details do not bring a person closer to God, not in love of God, not in fear of God. So what's the Rambam need to add that? Even if these things would bring you closer to God, knowing if Mashiach's donkey is black or gray would make you a bigger Yirei Shamayim. But since these things are not conclusive, no one knows. The Rabban Shom did not give a tradition, not to the prophets, not to the Chachamim, concerning these things. So it still shouldn't be the mainstay of your learning. There are plenty of things in Torah that bring you closer to God. So better to learn the things that are clear than the things that aren't clear. Why did the Rambam add this? What does it add to this halacha? What difference does it make if it brings you closer to Hashem or not? It still you shouldn't make it the mainstay of your learning. Why does the Rambam have to add that in? I was thinking the Rambam is, with that last sentence, answering an unasked question that begs to be asked in this Rambam. And that is, why wasn't there a tradition that was clear concerning these details? The Rambam made that statement that there's no details, there's no clarity in these details. But why not? Why didn't the Ribbono Shel Olam give a prophecy to the prophets concerning these details in clarity? Clearly. Why didn't he give a Masorah to the Chachamim? Why didn't he give a tradition to the Chachamim? Why were these things left obscure? And that, the Rambam says, because they don't bring a person not to Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem. What the Torah put into the Torah is only that which will bring you closer to Hashem. And if it doesn't fulfill that purpose, it's not there. Torah means Horah. It means something that will guide you and inspire you and lead you closer to HaKadosh Baruch. And therefore, if it doesn't fulfill that purpose, it's not there. So therefore, since these things don't bring Lidei Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem, knowing if Mashiach's donkey is black or gray is not going to make you a better person, a bigger Yirei Shamayim, the Torah deletes it. It didn't tell it to the prophets and put it in the written Torah. It didn't tell it to the Chacham, put it in the oral Torah. The only things that are in the written or oral Torah are not things that are interesting tidbits of knowledge alone, but things that have the potential, if you learn them properly, to bring you closer to the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's what Torah is. In the same vein, Rabbi Chezkel Avramsky explains the second to the last pasuk in Megillas Esther in the following way. The pasuk says, "V'chol ma'asei sakpo u'gvuraso." Uparashas Gedulas Mordechai, Halohem Ksuvim al Sifrei Divrei Hayomim Lamalchei Madei Uparas. The greatness and strength of the deeds of Mordechai are recorded in the books of the history books of the kings of Persia and Madai. Chezkel Avramsky says, what's the purpose of this sentence? Why does Megillas Esther end with a footnote, as if to say, for further information on this topic, if you found learning about Mordechai HaYehudi in this Megillah interesting, you can find further information in the history books of the kings of Persia and Modern. Whoever looked them up, whoever had access to them, they're not what's in the public library. These were the special history books that were in the king's palace. Anybody ever go knock on the door and say, you know, I have a footnote in my Megillah Esther. It says I should look up the history of Mordechai in your books. Could you share? Can I take it out? Absurd. What's the purpose of it? Says Rabbi Chezkel Avramsky, the Megillah is defining itself. If you want to know the historical background of this period, if you want to know historical information about Mordechai, this is not the place to find it. Go look in the history books of the kings of Persia and Modai. This is Torah. You won't find history in Megillah Esther, even though there are historical episodes. But it's not a history book. Because if it was a history book, it would be a pretty miserable history book. Because it has an episode from the first year, the third year, the fifth year, the seventh year of Achashverosh. Persian history has so many more episodes. It pulls a little bit out here, a little bit there. No, Megillas Esther has one purpose in mind. To make you a bigger God-fearing and God-loving person. And by presenting you with the miracle of Purim, that is accomplished. So whatever is necessary to impress upon you God's love and God's justice that will make you an Oy Vashem and Yirei Hashem is mentioned in Megillas Esther. Every detail. There's no detail there that's not necessary to really impress upon you the greatness of the miracle and all of the intricacies of it. But if it doesn't serve that purpose, it's only there because it's an interesting historical fact of this period, it's not there. Not there. And if it is there, if you learn it properly, it will serve the purpose of bringing you closer to Hashem. So if you're looking for history, don't look here. If you're looking for Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem, then every single word and every single letter that's in this, this Megillah will achieve that purpose. There's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. The Mishnah says, Ba'asorah Mamoros Nivra Ha'olam. The world was created with 10 utterances. And our Mishnah says, the kol kach lama, why so many? For all, God could have created with one mimer. Why 10? Says, to tell you how precious the world is, that it should be preserved by tzaddikim, and how much reward they get for preserving a world that was created with 10 mamaros, not just one, and the wicked, how much punishment they get in order if they destroy a world of 10 mamaros. I don't understand the question of our Mishnah. How did the Tana know that God could have created the world with one mimer? Maybe he could. Maybe he needed 10. Not that he couldn't, but maybe the way you create worlds is with 10. It's like asking a question, how come God made 5 fingers on every hand? Couldn't he created 1 finger, 20 fingers? Couldn't he made 80 fingers? He could have. But he knew that 5 fingers makes a hand functional. So when you create hands, you put 5 fingers on them. That's a hand. So same thing, maybe when you create worlds, you need 10 mamaras. I don't know. How did the Tana know? He never created any worlds. He was so categoric, like, well, God could have done it with one. Maybe not. Maybe he needed 10. You look in the Ovis of Nosson, the Brisa of Pirkei Avos, it says the question a little bit differently, which can be understood to be the question of our Mishnah too. There the question is asked the following way. Why do human beings have to know that? That's a question. Meaning, when our Mishnah asked the question, it wasn't asking a question on God. It was asking a question on the Torah. The Kol Kach Lama, why so many? Not why did God have to use so many. Why do I have to know there were so many? Who cares? What do I have to know that there were 10 mamaros in creating the world? What is this, a do-it-yourself kit, how to create worlds? In case you ever create a world, do it with 10 mamaros. I'm not going to create worlds. I'm boy Olo. I came into this world. I don't have to create worlds. Why do I have to know how many mamaros you need to create a world? What do I need it for? Why did the Torah tell me? And the answer is, that's interesting. Interesting things alone are not in the Torah. Tidbits of knowledge are not in the Torah. The Torah is something that brings you closer to Hashem. That's its purpose. So why do I need to know that there are 10 mamaras? On that, the Mishnah answers, no, I have to know that because it makes the world a more individually important place. It's not that just God created the world collectively. In general, everything was a separate mimer. Everything is important. Every individual is important. Everything is singularly important. And that tells me that people who preserve the world get a tremendous reward, and people who destroy the world get a tremendous punishment. It makes me a bigger Ohei Hashem and a Yirei Shamayim. But that's the question. Why is it necessary for me to know that there are 10 mamaras? Who cares? For all I care, there could be one. And don't tell me it's there because it's interesting, because that's not Torah. Similarly, the Mishnah goes on. Asara Doros me Adam liyad Noach. There were 10 generations from Adam to Noah. The Torah lists them. Asara Doros me Noach ad Avram. There are 10 generations from Noach Avram. And the others from Nosson asks the same question on these. V'chi matzorech leboy olam b'kach. Who cares? Why do I have to know there were 10 generations and who they were between Adam and Noah? It's great for history books. Why from the Torah? Why did the Torah tell me a bunch of history? A bunch of names and dates and years? Who cares, Torah-wise? The answer is yes, there's lessons from each one of these things. The first one teaches me how patient God is. That all these 10 generations from Adam to Noah angered God, and he didn't destroy them until he finally brought them out. And the Rabbeinu Yonah says it teaches me 2 lessons. One is that God is patient, and the other that his patience has a limit. That eventually he destroyed them. So it teaches me to love God for his patience and to fear God for the ultimate result when he runs out of patience. And the second 10 generations is to teach me that many people can live, not fulfill their purpose, and one person can come and get the reward for all of them, Avraham Avinu. Based on this, I want to explain something I think that is very interesting. If you look at the account of the 10 generations between Adam and Noah, and the account the Torah gives of the 10 generations between Noah and Avram, you'll find that they are not parallel. They are not one unified style. Two different styles. It doesn't make sense. Why would God, the same author, give me a list of 10 generations in one parasha, in the next parasha another list of 10 generations, and do it in a different way? You would expect the style to be parallel. In the first 10 generations, the Torah uses 3 sentences to describe each generation. For instance, Sheis, okay, the son of Adam. Vayechi Sheis, so many and so many years. Vayoled es Arpachshad. Sheis lived so many and so many years, and he gave birth to Arpachshad, his main son. After that, Sheis lived so many and so many years, and he gave birth to other children. And Sheis lived, the third sentence, a total of X years, and he died. Three sentences about each generation. How old he was when he had his main child, how long he lived after that and had other children, how long he lived total and died. You would expect the same thing in this week's Sedra, in the 10 generations between Noah and Avram. And yet, in this week's Sedra, it's a different setup. Vayechi Shem, so many years, Vayoled es, what's it called? No, Vayesh was Enosh, not Arpachshad. Here's Arpachshad. Shem had Arpachshad. So Vayechi Shem, so many years, Vayoled es Arpachshad. Vayechi Shem acharei holidu es Arpachshad, so many years, Vayoled bonim ubonos. He had other children, and that's the end of Shem. We leave him, go to the next generation. Vayechi Arpachshad. Doesn't tell you how old he was when he died, nor does it even mention that he died. Just tells you two sentences about each individual. The third sentence is left out in the 10 generations between Noah and Abraham. Why? The answer, I think, is very, very simple. Because the lesson of the first 10 generations is what? That God is patient, but his patience has a limit. So what do I have to know to really have that message struck home? I have to know that these people lived, that they were numerous, and they all died peacefully in their beds at 800, 900 years old. Because if I don't know that, if it's not said, and they lived 800 years and they died, then maybe they were struck down by lightning when they were 40 or 50. Maybe they died terrible, violent deaths when they were 800 or 900. But when it says they died natural deaths at 800, 900, I know that God is merciful. These people were wicked and God didn't destroy them till the end of 10 generations. The second lesson, how much of that information do I have to know to learn the second lesson? And many people lived, didn't fulfill their purpose, and one person can come and get the reward for all of it. Do they have to know they lived? Yeah. Do I have to know they had children? Yeah. There were a lot of them? Yeah. Do I have to know they died? No. It has nothing to do with the lesson. I don't have to know they died. I surely don't have to know how old they were when they died. It doesn't make a difference to me. Just that they lived, they didn't fulfill their purpose, and Avraham Avinu came along and got the reward for all of them. For that, I don't have to know they died also. Therefore, since it's not germane, it's not relevant to the lesson, it's not there. The Torah only records those things that help bring you closer to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And the reason why these 10 generations were written was to teach you this lesson. And for that lesson, you don't need that last sentence. It's not there. I'd be interesting, that interesting tidbit of knowledge, in case you ever played the trivia, you'd be able to answer how old these people were when they died. It's not there. Because the Torah does not convey interesting tidbits of knowledge. It conveys Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem. And therefore, the Ramban says that when Torah is used in conjunction with all the other parts of the Torah, mitzvahs, chukim, mishpatim, so what does Torah mean specifically? Torah can mean the umbrella of everything. But when it's used in conjunction with other details, what is the Torah part of Torah is the story part of Torah. But that seems a little incongruous with its meaning. Torah means horah, what teaches you, what guides you, what shows you. But that's exactly the point. That's the purpose of these stories. They're not there just for information's sake. They're there to teach you Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem. That is the Torah. And the Zohar says that the Torah is all mitzvahs. Just some are clothed in stories and some are open. But underlying everything is mitzvah, meaning it's a command, it's a guidance, it's an enlightenment. It's something that teaches you how to live your life in a way that you'll be a bigger Ohev Hashem and Yirei Shamayim. Says that Menashe HaMelech lost his share in the world to come because he was Doresh Drosho Shel Dofi Megale Ponim BaTorah Shelo Kalach. Simple meaning is that he dealt with the Torah with tremendous chutzpah. Megale Ponim means that he dealt with the Torah with a brazen face, with an uncovered face. Chutzpah. What was his chutzpah? So the Gemara says, Shel Doresh Drosho Shel Dofi. He made foolish drushes. And he gives an example. What was his foolish drusha? He said, didn't Moshe have anything better to write than Timna Haisa Pilegesh Eliphaz Ben Esau? That Timna was a concubine to Eliphaz, the son of Esau. Oh, and the world cares. Didn't Moshe have anything better to write than that? But it doesn't say what his drasha of Dofi was. He asked the question, what was his drasha? I was thinking what it means is the following. That's exactly what Menashe said. Menashe said, Moshe Rabbeinu wrote this just as information. God told him to write it. It's an interesting historical fact. That's it. That's called Megala Ponim Batorah Shaloka Halacha. There are many ponim, Harbe Ponim LaTorah. There are many facets to the Torah. 70 facets, whatever. All different angles of learning things from the Torah. All different ways. But they all are halacha. They all teach you and guide you and inspire you. They're not there just to give you information. He was Megalit Panim Batorah. He uncovered and revealed facets of the Torah, Shalok Halacha, that have nothing to do with Halacha, that were just information. That's, for that you lose your share in the world to come. That diminishes the Torah into a book of information and not into a divine guiding force. That's what Torah is. That's called Megalit Panim Batorah, Shalok Halacha. And Taka, what do we learn from that pasuk? Chazal said. So what do we need? Timna Haisa Pilegesh. Because Timna was a princess. She grew up in a royal home. And she said, I'd rather be a concubine in the black sheep of this family. She tried to join the family of Avram. When she was a young woman, she came to convert and to join Avram's family. He rejected her. Pushed her away with two hands. And the rabbis say that he was wrong. He shouldn't have rejected her with two hands. You bring close with the right hand, you reject with the left hand. You never reject somebody totally. And then she came back as a middle-aged woman in the time of Yitzchak. And he rejected her. She came back as an old lady in Yaakov's time. And he rejected her. And she said, if I can't get into this family through the front door, I'm going to come through the back door. And she became a Pilegesh, a concubine, to the Esav son. She said, I'd rather be a concubine in this family, even in the black side of this family, than to be a princess somewhere else. So we learn the greatness of Avraham Avinu. Avas Hashem, Yiras Hashem, that's why the Torah wrote. And everything is like that. And if we look in Torah, we don't see the meaning. How does this make me a better Jew? How does this make me a better person? How does it bring me closer to the Rabbanu Shalom? If you don't see it, it's not because it's not there. Because if it's in the Torah, it's there. It has to have that purpose. He says, Ki lo dovar reiku mikem. The Torah is not something empty from you. And Chazal comment, the Imreku, and if it looks empty, Mikam, it's your fault. You didn't learn it properly. You didn't delve into it enough. You don't know what you're looking at. Not empty. Never empty. There's always a lesson. There's always something that should guide you. And if you don't see it, it's Mikam, it's your fault. Not because the Torah lacks that meaning. You don't see it. Learn a little bit more. Delve in a little bit greater. Ask somebody. You'll see it. There's something to it. Therefore, everything is mitzvahs. So that's Rashi's question. That's Rabbi Yitzchak's question. The Torah should have started from the first obvious mitzvah. You know why? Because when you write a book, Mahavdil, one of the rules of creative writing is that when the first few paragraphs of the book, it should be clear what the theme of the book is. What kind of book is this? Somebody who picks up the book should be able to discern within the first two, three paragraphs what he's reading. Is this a novel? Is it science? Is it history? What is it? And therefore, had the Torah started with the first obvious mitzvah, it would have set the pattern. What is this book all about? It's mitzvahs. And then when it had the first story, you would understand the story in light of being a mitzvah that's clothed in a story. But if the Torah starts with a story, what appears to be a story, there's a chance that you'll misunderstand the whole thing. And you'll think it's not a story. You won't realize that it's a mitzvah clothed as a story. So the most logical place is to start from the first mitzvah and then put the stories. So you put everything into context. So Taka, why didn't it start from the first mitzvah? Why did it start from Bereishis? That's the question. What's the answer? First of all, you should realize the answer is that the Torah does start from the first mitzvah. It starts from HaKodesh HaZeh Lochem. And everything before that is not a beginning, it's a preface. It's a forward. Listen to the Lashon of Rashi. L'hoya Torah l'haskil ele me'achodesh hazeh lochem. U'matam posach b'breishis. What should it have said? U'matam hiskil b'breishis. It shouldn't have started except from achodesh hazeh lochem. So why did it start from Bereshis? It doesn't say that. It says Matam Posach Bereshis, which means the Torah really started from Acholish Azalachem. That's the beginning of the Torah. But before you start, you have a few Roman numeral pages that are a forward, a preface to the Torah. That's called Bereshis. You need, before you can start the first mitzvah, you need a preface to the Torah. That preface is Bereshis. Just something cute. Based on this idea, I can explain a difficult Gemara in Avodah Zorah. The Gemara says that Lasid Lava, Kadosh Baruch Hu, is going to take a Sefer Torah, and he's going to announce, whoever kept it, come and get your reward, and the Goyim are going to come, and they're going to demand reward. And finally, in the end, the Rabbanim is going to say, you don't deserve reward for what you did in this world. So they're going to say, look, you know, true lanu also meirosh v'naseno. Give us the Torah from the beginning, and we'll do it now. Give us another chance. Like, you know, give it again. So the words don't make sense. Tanu lanu osam meirosh v'naseno. As if, turn the world clock back, and make the world again, and give it to us retroactively. Doesn't make sense. But they want it is, give us the Torah now. Tanu lanu osa achshav. Give it now. What's meirosh? I was thinking what it means is the following. Had the Goyim accepted the Torah, it wouldn't have started with Bereshis, because Bereshis was needed just for the sake of the Jewish people, as we'll see in a few seconds. So their Torah wouldn't have started with Bereshis. It wouldn't have had that forward. It would have started from where the Torah is supposed to start, the first mitzvah. Where is that? HaChodesh HaZeh Lochem. But that also wouldn't have been given to the Goyim, because that mitzvah would have still specifically been in the hands of the Jewish people to declare when the Rosh Chodesh was, when the new moon was. There still would be Jews and Goyim. The Goyim would also receive the Torah, but they wouldn't get all the Torah, they'd get only the Torah that applied to them, not the Torah applied only to Jews. So HaChodesh HaZeh Lochem, those words also wouldn't apply to Goyim. What's the first word after that? HaChodesh HaZeh Lochem Rosh Chodoshim. That's what they said. Tnu lanu osa me rosh v'na'asena. Give us the Torah from the word rosh and we'll keep it. Because Bereshis doesn't apply to us. HaChodesh HaZeh Lochem doesn't apply to us. So the first word in the Torah applies to us is rosh. So tnu lanu osa me rosh v'na'asena. Okay, that's just an aside. But the Torah started from HaChodesh HaZeh Lochem and it put a preface in for us of Bereshis. Why? So Rashi says, Koach Ma'isov Higid Li Amo Loses Lohem Nachlas Goyim. Based on a pasuk in Tehillim, the Rabbanu Shem told us the strength of his works, the fact that he created the world, in order to give us the inheritance of other nations. That in case the Goyim will ever come, theoretically speaking, and they ever will claim that we stole from them Eretz Israel, it's not our land, it's their land, they settled it, we conquered it, we took it away from them, right? So we have an answer. Bereshis Bara Elokim. God created the world. True. He gave it to you, took it away from you, gave it to us. It's his world. So God gave us this land. So in order to have a claim on Eretz Israel, we need Bereshis before the first mitzvah. I don't understand that at all. First of all, is it going to help? Right? The Goyim are going to come in the United Nations and they're going to say, these Jews are occupiers, they stole our land, we poor Palestinians were there, just like the Chittim and the Girgashim or whatever, and they were plain Canaan living in this land, the Jews came out of Egypt, and they conquered the land from our ancestors or whatever, and then they conquered again in 1948, and our ambassador will get up, and he will say, it says right here in our Torah that God created the world. It also says that he gave Eretz Israel to our forefather, Avraham Avinu. He promised to him, yes, he gave it to you temporarily, took it away from you, gave it to us. And then all the ambassadors in the United Nations will get up and say, hey, can't even say that before. All this strife, all this, right? Look, he'd said that before. We have no problem with that. Oh, yeah, God created the world. He gave it to you, took it away from us. Yeah, okay, fine. Right? I don't think that will be the reaction. Right? I don't think they could really care what it says in the Torah. What it says in our Torah for sure not. So how's it going to help? Secondly, even if it would help, why does it have to be in the beginning of the Torah? It could be the last footnote to the Torah, a little star, a little asterisk at the end of the Torah that says, Bereshis Bara Elokim. Right? We didn't need it in the beginning of the Torah. We need it before we conquered Eretz Israel. The Torah was given 40 years. It was finished 14 years before we ever finished conquering Eretz Israel, before the Goyim could have any complaint. So why not end the Torah with that? Why is that the beginning? Let the Torah start from Achodesh Alachem and end with a footnote about Bereshis Bar Elokim. And the truth is, the Gemara in Sanhedrin says that the Goyim in the time of Alexander the Great came with that claim. We stole their land. And we sent a representative, his name was Gvia ben Psisa. And he went to argue with them. So what do you think he's going to say? Ah, Bereshis Bar Elokim, we got it. We have a whole sefer Bereshis to tell us this. When you have your question, we've been waiting for this. He didn't even mention Bereshis Bar. You know what he said? He said, you're right. Eretz Canaan belongs to you. It says in the Torah, Eretz Canaan. But you belong to us, because it says that Canaan is an Evid, is a slave to Shem. So you own Canaan, we own you. Whatever a slave owns, the old master owns. And yet, not only that, you haven't served us for quite a few years. We'd like back wages. So they ran away. But he should have said, this has been waiting, the whole Sefer Bereishis has been waiting since it's been written for this question. He didn't even mention it. And I have a bigger question. Much more serious question. If God was so concerned that the nations of the world think that we are robbers, conquerors, occupiers, murderers, because we didn't just take their land. We killed their men, women, and children. It was a mitzvah. Right? You weren't allowed to leave anybody alive. Genocide. We killed out all these Canaan. We gave them a chance to run away. We told them, we're coming, and if we conquer you, we're going to kill every single man, woman, and child. You have the option of running away. And one group did run away, the Girgashi. They ran away, and the Panavish Yerov used to say they ran away to Africa. The Gemara says to Africa. He says South Africa. That's where they ran, and God gave them a land in South Africa that's equal to Eretz Yisrael in beauty. It's the Panavish Yerov used to say. So one nation took advantage of the warning. The other ones didn't, but they know that they're going to fight us. We're going to annihilate them. So, and God is concerned that the nations of the world are going to think we're a bunch of robbers, occupiers, murderers. So then why did he give us Eretz Yisrael in such a suspicious way? I have ideas how he could have given us Eretz Yisrael in a very benign way. He could have made the economic situation here in the land at the time that we came to occupy the land very, very bad. So all the inhabitants of this land, all the Canaanim, would have run away to New York, opened falafel stands, drove in cabs, right? And they would have left the land ownerless, and we would come in and just take it over. We didn't kill anybody, we didn't conquer anybody. They all left. It's very logical. It happens, right? Even today it happens. Right? How many Israelis are there in New York driving cabs and selling falafel? Right? Or in Baltimore or in Chicago or who knows where? God could have made it that, you know, induce them to leave. Or he could have made them all drop dead from heart attacks at one moment. And all of a sudden, everybody, oh, bar, finish. Right? And we come into the land, and we would do a service to the world and bury these people. Right? Full rights. And for free. And then the world would have said, wow, nice people. They came in, buried all these people who happened to drop dead before they came. And nobody would say we were robbers or murderers. Instead, God gives us the land in a way that we have to conquer it, we have to kill all these people, and then he wants to have us, we have safer Bereshis so we don't look like robbers and murderers. Why? Why give it in such a suspicious way that you need something to cover it up, safer Bereshis? Don't give it in a suspicious way. Give it in a nice, benign way. Let me tell you what I think. There seems to be an argument between the Vilna Gaon and the Dubna Magid that's very hard to imagine. Because the Dubna Magid and the Vilna Gaon were contemporaries, and the Dubna Magid was a Talmud Chaver of the Vilna Gaon. He considered himself his student, but he was a friend student, almost an equal as a student, because the Vilna Gaon used to call the Dubna Magid to give him Musar. So to say that they had divergent hashkafas is hard to say. But here is the two things, one the Vilna Gaon said, one the Dubna Magid said. You'll see that there's a complete seemingly contradiction between them. One says one thing, the other one says diametrically opposed. Let's start with the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon explains the following pasuk in Megillas Rus. Says that Naomi was discouraging Rus from traveling with her to Eretz Israel and becoming Jewish, like you have to discourage a convert. Until Vatera ki misametzes hi laleches ima ita. When she saw she was making such an effort to come with her, she stopped talking to her and she stopped discouraging her. Says the Vilna Gaon, what does it mean? It means like this. He says, when a person does a mitzvah, if it's merely done l'shem shamayim, it's merely done proper, the satan doesn't want it done. So he puts up a tremendous amount of resistance. And he makes it very difficult for you to do that mitzvah. And therefore, the more difficult the mitzvah is, the bigger a proof that it must be being done l'shem shamayim. Because if you're not doing it l'shem shamayim, the satan couldn't care less. Do whatever you want. And he doesn't bother you. He doesn't make it difficult. So when Naomi saw that Ruth is struggling to keep up with her, an old lady, she's a young woman, it must be the satan's making it very difficult for her to fulfill this mitzvah of going along with her to Eretz Yisrael. Must be that it's l'shem shamayim. Must be really a good mitzvah. And therefore she stopped trying to discourage her. She saw that she must really mean it, l'shem shamayim. So what do we see from the Vilna Gaon? The more difficult the mitzvah, the more of a sign that it's really a good mitzvah. Comes to Dugna Magid, he says a different word. And another pasuk in the Navi. Pasuk says, Lo osi karosa Yaakov ki yagata bi Yisrael. You haven't called on me, Yaakov, because you are toiling too much. Says the Dugna Magid, a marshal, as is usual, story. What's the story that illustrates this? A guy comes to the train station, and he forgets his baggage in the train station. Goes home, and he's too tired to go back. So he asks his neighbor, could you do me a favor and go pick up my baggage in the train station? So the guy, half an hour later, he hears him huffing and puffing, one step at a time, dragging this luggage up the stairs. Knocks on the door, he says, I got your luggage. He says, no, you didn't. He says, how do you know? You didn't even open the door. He says, because not my luggage, you took somebody else's by mistake. He says, how in the world do you know that I took somebody else's by mistake? You didn't even look to see. He said, because all I had was a small attaché case. I hear you huffing and puffing and dragging who knows what, safes up the stairs. That's not my luggage. Go back and get my luggage. So too says the Dubna Makid. If it's so difficult to keep mitzvahs, you're not doing my mitzvahs, because my mitzvahs are easy to do. My mitzvah is just a small attaché case. If you think it's hard to do, and you're lo osi karos, you're not calling on me, you're not doing my mitzvahs, ki yagata bi Yisrael, because you're putting too much toil into it. If it's so difficult, it's not mine. Mine are easy. Now that's diametrically the opposite of what the Vilna Gaon said. Vilna Gaon says, if it's not difficult, if it's easy, that's not real mitzvah. And then the Dugna Magid says, if it's hard, it's not a real mitzvah. My mitzvahs are easy. Do what you say. Let me tell you what I think. There are two levels, two stages in the performance of mitzvahs. I'll give you two examples and we'll see how it works. Let's take two young men in high school, yeshiva high school in America. And both of them are very, very talented, very smart, good midos, boys that if they stayed learning full time, they both would be Gedolei Yisrael. How do I know? I made up the marshal. I can make up any way I want. So, for sure, there's no doubt. They definitely will become the next two leaders of the Jewish people if they stay learning full-time. They could go and still remain B'nai Torah, and go to college part-time and learn part-time, but they won't be Gedolei Yisrael. They won't be. They'll be fine doctors, B'nai Torah, who will contribute to the world and to Judaism, but they won't be Gedolei Yisrael. Now, they have pressures on them from their parents, right? Why don't you go to get a career, be able to earn a living, right? From relatives, from their rabbis tell them, you have the potential to be the next Rabbi Kiva Eger, the next Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Stay by learning. You're going to be, Klal Yisrael needs you. And they're being bombarded from all sides, right? What to do. Now, these two boys come from two different backgrounds. One of them grew up in a society we're familiar with. A society that if you tap somebody on the shoulder, right, in the middle of Times Square, and you said, excuse me, sir, could you define success for me? What do you think the answer would be?
Money.
Money. Exactly. Money. Money, because money gives pleasure, power, whatever, right? That is success. Successful life, you're a rich person. You're a person who's in control. Success is spelled with a dollar sign, not with an S. Okay, that's the mainly. And even we, Jews, right, even from Jews, Lamaisa have to be affected by that feeling. From the time that you're born, you see billboards and you hear radio or television, whatever, you're bombarded with success, meaning being rich. Right? You see it on the billboard. If you buy this car, you'll be successful. Right? You'll be a rich person. You have to be a rich person to buy the car to begin with. But okay, that's a stomach cock. Hey, smoke this cigarette, you'll be a successful person, because people who smoke this cigarette are dressed in nice suits and they have money and whatever, and they have all the accoutrements of wealth around them, power and whatever, and pleasures. So that gives you a subliminal message that, you know, if you smoke this cigarette, it's going to make you a successful person. And success is rich, powerful. On the other hand, let's say you were brought up in a society that was a total Torah society. If you ask the Torah, what is the definition of success? What answer do you think you would get there? Definitely not money. So what would it be? A life that will give you the greatest share in the world to come. In a nutshell, okay? Good midos, mitzvos, hashkafos, whatever will give you the greatest share in the world to come, that's a successful life. Imagine if there was a society that was based on that philosophy. So the billboards wouldn't say, if you smoke this cigarette, right, you'll be rich and powerful. It would have a guy with that cigarette in his mouth. Probably wouldn't have a guy with any cigarette in his mouth altogether, but just for argument's sake, let's just use the same parallels. And around him would be, what's it called, a lot of kids who are, what's it called, really Yirei Shamayim. He has a family that all of them are coming, they have fun, and he has a whole shas in the background or whatever that he's worn out and finished 20 times. So if you smoke this cigarette, you'll learn shas 20 times. You'll have your children that are coming to Chacham, and you'll have good midos, right? This will improve your midos. Whatever it would be, that would be the subliminal, message. And that would be what our reflex action would be. It wouldn't be that when we hear success, reflex would be money. And then we'd say, no, that's not really what it is. I know it's not like that. But your reflex reaction, because of your experience, right, of what bothered you since you were a kid, if you grew up in that society, that's your reflex reaction. But if you grew up in the other society, just the opposite. Your reflex reaction would be success, mitzvahs, midos, whatever. So now these two boys grew up in these two different societies. The one who, what's it called, who grew up in the society we're familiar with, he has a tremendous nisayon. It's hard for him to keep the mitzvah. You know why? Because really he knows he should be learning Torah full time. He's going to be the next Gadol Hador. Right? He really has a responsibility to Klal Yisrael. And if he doesn't stay by Torah the whole time, the Klal Yisrael is going to be missing a Gadol. So he knows that's what's right. But he has to sacrifice success for that. Because in his mind, success is money, career, etc., etc. But he's willing to sacrifice success to do what's right. That's a nisayon. That's not easy to do. That's hard. But the other guy, his understanding of success is midos, Torah. If he stays full-time by Torah, he's not sacrificing anything. Adarava, he's getting success. Why in the world would he want to sacrifice success to go to college? This guy, his outlook, his basis, his standards, his values are all Torah. So the keeping the Torah on a Torah base is easy. That's what the Torah was meant for. But if you try to keep the Torah on a foreign base, then the Torah is extremely difficult. It's like taking something round and trying to put it on a square base. It doesn't fit. If your values and your standards are foreign to Torah, but you want to keep the Torah, then you're going to have a nisayon, you're going to have a test and a difficulty every step along the way. Because here, this is success, and the Torah wants you to give up success. But if you have Torah standards and values, then it fits the Torah. What the Torah wants fits perfectly on the base that the Torah has. If you have the right standards and values and outlooks and philosophies, there's no problem keeping the Torah. It's very easy. It was meant to be on this base, but if it's on a different base, it's going to be very, very difficult. Somebody once said, an older Rav in New York, and he was very active in the 40s, 50s, eludes me now. But in any case, he said, people who want to live according to the standards and philosophy of the nations of the world, but they want to be frum, they want to keep 613 mitzvahs, they don't have 613 mitzvahs. They have 613 problems. Because every mitzvah presents another problem to them because it goes against the grain of their lifestyles, of their values, of their standards. In order for the Torah to be mitzvahs and easy, it has to go with the grain of your values and your standards. You have to start with the right foundation, with the right framework. Memela, before you can start the first mitzvah, you have to have first the right outlook on life. Who makes the standards? What's moral? What's immoral? What's right? What's wrong? What's important? What's not important? What's a goal? What's not a goal? Before you define all of that, you can't start with the first mitzvah. Because it would be impossible to keep mitzvahs if your definitions of all these standards and values are not Torah standards and values. So before you get to the first mitzvah, you need a preface. That preface is Bereishis. Now let's see what Bereishis told me. Why do we get Eretz Yisrael? Why do we need Eretz Yisrael? Why don't Jews just live wherever they want or whatever? Why do we need Eretz Yisrael? The main purpose of Eretz Yisrael is to create an insulated society, not isolated, insulated society where Torah values and Torah standards and Torah goals and Torah philosophy permeates the entire society and therefore enables people to live a holy life. Because you're basing your functioning, your living on a Torah environment. So everything is Torah. If you live amongst the nations of the world, you're going to be affected by their standards and their values. And try to keep Torah based on those standards and values is going to be very difficult. So the whole purpose of Eretz Yisrael is to engender this purpose, to engender this goal. Set your foundation, and then you can keep mitzvahs. If the foundation is round and the mitzvahs are round, you're perfect. But if you're going to make a square foundation, try to put something round on it, it's not going to work. It's going to be very difficult. So the Rebbe Shlomo says like this, I'm going to give you Eretz Yisrael in a way that in the eyes of the nations of the world, you are robbers, murderers, occupiers. But in my eyes, you are loyal servants. If you base your standards and values on the nations of the world, then you have absolutely no claim to Eretz Yisrael. But you know what? You don't even need Eretz Yisrael. Because the whole purpose of Eretz Yisrael is defeated if you're going to create your society and your standards and your values on their perspectives. The only way you have a claim on Eretz Yisrael and the only way you need Eretz Yisrael is if you base your standards and values and morals on me. And I'm telling you that you're not murderers and you're not robbers and you're not occupiers. You are fulfilling my command. I gave these people life. I have a right to take it away from them in any way I want. And I can command you to take it away. It's the only difference between us and Hitler. Hitler didn't have a divine command from the one who gave the people that he took their lives away. And we had a divine command. It's the only difference. You believe it, you believe it. You don't believe it, then there's no difference. Our only answer is God commanded us to do it. And it's true. And the same Christians who say that God commanded them to kill Jews in the Inquisition, right? If it would be true, it would be one thing. It's not true. It's not true. They did it on their own. They're murderers. We didn't do it on our own. We did it because God told us. If you don't believe that, then we are murderers. So God said, I'm going to give you Eretz Yisrael. I'm going to give it to you in a way that you're forced to base your standards, values, morals on me. Because if you don't, you are robbers, murderers, and occupiers in the eyes of the nations of the world. You want Eretz Yisrael? Then understand what the foundation of Torah is. The preface to the whole Torah is setting the right standards, values, outlooks, philosophies, and so on. Before you can get to the first mitzvah, true, Torah's mitzvahs, and Torah starts with the first mitzvah. But if you don't have Bereishis Bara Elokim, you don't have the entire Sefer Bereishis that teaches me what a Jewish outlook to the world is. That's what you get from Bereishis, the Avos. How did they look at the world? How did they live in the world? And the people who are the antagonists of the Avos, how did they live? What's the antithesis of the Avos? Avram, Nimrod. Yitzchak, Avimelech. Yaakov and Esau. Yishmael and Yitzchak. And so throughout the entire Torah. What is the Torah perspective? What's the antithesis of that? If you don't have that down pat, then you can't start the first mitzvah. You want to start with mitzvahs? Fine. But you have to start with a preface. The preface is voracious. Putting things into perspective. Once you have the right perspective, the mitzvahs are easy. Therefore, the Vilna Gaon is not talking about actually performing the mitzvahs. He's talking about getting to the situation where you have the right perspective, like Rus was. she was contemplating converting, going to Eretz Israel. It wasn't any specific mitzvah she was doing at the time. She was accepting upon herself that mode of thought, that value system. That's very difficult. Very, very difficult. But once you have it, then like the Dugna Maggid says, the mitzvah is the reason. Once you have the right outlook, once you have the right value system, keeping mitzvahs is a cinch. It's an easy thing. If it's difficult, it means that it's a conflict. You don't have the right values, not my mitzvahs. But getting those values, creating that preface, making that system, that's extremely difficult. If it comes too easy, then you're not doing it right. So the Vilna Gaon is talking about creating the environment for Torah, the Bereishis. And the Dubna Maggid says, once you have that Bereishis, HaChodesh HaZalachem is a shuit after that, and keep the mitzvahs very easily, once you have the right base. So that's why the Torah should have started from HaChodesh HaZalachem, because it's really only mitzvahs. But before you can start mitzvahs, you have to have the right value system, that's Sefer Bereishis, and that was given through our claim to Eretz Israel, which creates that value system. If you accept that value system, then you have a claim. If you don't accept it, you don't have a claim, you don't need a claim, because you don't need Eretz Israel. There's no purpose for it.